We're beginning now tape two, and we were talking, Mr. Rabinsky was talking about you were a first wave coming from Ellis Island, and here's this punk kid coming in, and tell the situation again.
Well, we arrived at this lifeboat station, or surf station, and the one I went to first was the one that, as I said before, it's Spermaceti Cove, which is halfway down on Sandy Hook. At the time, we ate and slept in the boathouse, or the main building, but there were eight little cottages or huts around surrounding the station, and that's where the surfmen lived, who had been there for years. And when we arrived, we were seamen. There was a little friction between us, but we got to know each other better, and we finally sort of got acclimated. But then when the time came that I made a rate, I became a third-class petty officer, a coxswain, I suddenly became the second senior man at the station. And of course, as you can well imagine, that didn't sit too well with the rest of the troops. So I was transferred out of there. I guess it coincided with the onset of the war. But that's how they took care of that.
Uh-huh. So they were the ones that took such pride in their...
Well, they were a close-knit people. They lived on a beach all their lives. They were Coast Guardsmen, surfmen. See, it used to be known as a life-saving, U.S. life-saving service. And as he said before, the three branches more or less merged. And I was fortunate in sort of getting a good taste of all branches, even I was a commanding officer of a lot of buoy tenders. And that, you know, I encountered people from the old lighthouse service, and there was a little bit of getting used to each other then, see, because I was I was a regular Coast Guardsman, you might say. But we got acclimated, and everything worked all right. But we met, one of the joys of coming to this receiving station at Ellis Island was sometimes it was like old home week. You'd meet people that you hadn't seen for years, or you would, meet people that were stationed at some Coast Guard station someplace else, you know, and they would all meet here at Ellis Island. But,
So Ellis Island had a good reputation as being safe here,
so.
In the Coast Guard?
Yes, yep.
There was no other place along the East Coast. Mm. The hub for the Coast Guard.
Yeah.
On the East Coast.
Yeah.
It'd be Boston, New York,
yeah.
On down. Mm. And all your orders, all your movement of personnel came through the Coast Guard station here.
See, the district office was right across at 42 Broadway, so that was close by too, you know, and you would get orders from there and then proceed to Ellis Island. And the reason I showed up at Ellis Island a couple of times was that, see, during the war and shortly after, when I got a commission, it was definitely a commission for temporary service. So when a year after the war's end, and I thought pretty comfortable in my commission, I got noticed that I was reverting back to my permanent status of chief bosun mate. And I have a set of orders and a discharge certificate right here at receiving station Ellis Island. So I was discharged and then reenlisted and then appointed an ensign or JG for temporary service, I forget which. So this went on and on until finally I made a permanent bosun, and then eventually, it wasn't until I was up at the academy in 63 or something like that, that I finally got a permanent commission as a lieutenant commander. So that was kind of a joy in our household.
He's talking about the Coast Guard, 3rd Coast Guard District was up here on Broadway, we had a, probably a Vice Admiral, he wasn't the full admiral. You calm down. I think he was one broad stripe and one probably one thin stripe. What's that? Rear admiral.
Rear admiral, yeah.
Well, I was stationed after I came out of the signal school. I was stationed over here on Pier 9, East River. And we managed the signal tower on Seaman Church Institute, which was on a tower effect. They built a wooden shanty on the catwalk around it, and they put in a door here and a door there, and we had a glass front that we could look over New York Harbor. And one day I'm up there with my cohort, and somebody tries to come in one of these doors, one of our side doors. Now, this was a restricted area, and I quickly went over and shoved my foot against the door and slammed it shut and said, "You can't come in here." He says, then he backed off. When he backed off, he had no shoulder boards on, but he had this gold striping on. Mm. And he said, "I can go in there, I'm your boss." So now I don't know what to do, because we had orders not to let anybody in that wasn't qualified. So I said, "I'm sorry, sir, you can't go in here, you've got to go down to the barge office." Mm. So he went down to the barge office. We had a lieutenant in charge of our detail, and he went down there storming mad about couldn't go into the signal tower. Well, his lieutenant said, "This is our orders come straight from Commandant 3rd, Commandant 9th States Coast Guard, and you have to have a special pass. Now, if you'd like to have a special pass to go up the signal tower, we'll issue you one, Admiral." No, so he went storming out. I don't think he ever got a special pass. And about 5 minutes later, I got a call from my lieutenant saying, "You did right, because if you hadn't, you would have been hung, because he had no authority there. He would be in the Commandant of the Coast Guard District. He had no authority in those signal towers." And
you know who spent some time here, too, that I'd forgotten about was Alex Haley. He got his early start writing, you know, right here, yeah. But he was a journalist, third-class journalist, and I guess he progressed from there. I'd forgotten
were
all about him.
Were you here at the same time?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Do you remember anything about him?
I remember him. As a matter of fact, see, he worked out of the district office there, at 3rd District Office, and I spent some time there. I mean, you know, I knew him and all that, but I never sort of, you know, I figured with all his fame and whatnot, I'm sure he wouldn't remember me, but they have quite a collection.
I don't know. Similar memories to you with the
Coast Guard. Well, the barge office here at that time.
Yeah, that's where I enlisted. Yeah.
But it was the old barge office.
Oh, the old barge office, right. No, it was that ramshackle old hall there.
Yeah.
And Lieutenant Butcher, Chief Bosun Butcher had my orders. I have a copy of my original orders, you know. And I was going to look him up. I get a retired newsletter, you know, every month, and I was going to call him and get to him, and then the next thing I read the page, you know, cross the bar, and it was too late. That's the kind of sad part of it. There are so many, you know, people are gone, and it's to the point where, there's no one really to talk to anymore, you know, about things like that.
Well, I think maybe it would be good on this tape to dispel the myth of the Coast Guard as being a very safe... would you talk to the issue of really what is it like being in the Coast Guard?
Well, World War I, the Coast Guard suffered the greatest casualties of all the armed service, percentage-wise, when the Tampa went down. I believe it was a Tampa.
Right, yeah. But see, this rivalry goes way back, you know, like we used to go down Sand Street when I first came into service. I mean, you were called hooligans. Well, if you weren't smiling, that'd be a free-for-all. And, you know, they'd say, step aside shallow water and let the deep sea roll in. Well, that's pretty stupid, you know, in this day and age. But at the time, you know, that was it. And for some reason or other, on these ships, some of the ships were Navy, like the Alhena I was on was Navy and Coast Guard manned. And there was some bitterness there. We were so adept at handling boats, and we handled landing boats. That was our job on these big transports. And of course, the crew was a little envious. There were some hard feelings. They transferred the Navy boys into the boats, lots of accidents. Then we'd go back to the thing. But by and large, this always existed, and it still exists today. Like they and this Combat Veterans Association, they lose. I still, and this is a hang up I have probably, I still resent the term Coastie. To me, that's like a cold cereal, and I'm a Coast Guardsman, you know. But it's become popular, and it's supposed to be an endearing term, maybe. But I even resent that to this day. But it just, you know, the Coast Guard fought in the wars. They took risks, that more so than probably anyone else. Maybe that accounted for the close bond between Marines and Coast Guard, because the Marines got ashore on the islands in the Pacific with Coast Guardsmen handling the landing boats. Our friend there, Douglas Monroe, the signalman, gave his life to
first
protect, you know, Marines.
Level of honor winner in World War II.
So it's just, it's one of those things. But I think you find that in everything, you know.
I think with the Navy, I can give you a couple of examples. As he said, the United States Coast Guard manned boats going through and back and forth through surf. So when they came along for invasion, who would they go to but the Coast Guard? Because we knew how to bring boats back and forth through surf. So that we went down to Little Creek, Virginia, and showed the Navy how to do that. Because the Navy always thought, oh, you don't beach boats, you put boats in the ocean, you know. Mm-hmm. So we showed the Navy how to do this thing. I think the greatest thrill I ever had is when we took a Navy destroyer in tow and took it into Jacksonville, Florida, Coast Guard cutter. And those guys on the boat, on the destroyer, Navy destroyer, were red-faced when they went into Jacksonville, pulled in by a little teeny Coast Guard cutter, you know. So that we stick the needle in too when they stick the needle in. But if you go back into World War II, the early part of the convoy duties, in the North Atlantic, the Coast Guard manned an awful lot of combat patrol vessels, convoy vessels, the cutters, and the cutters were some of the best cutters in the world, some of the best boats in the world for convoy duty. Your Campbell, the Spencer, and some of those big cutters were the best cutters in the world, because when your Navy destroyers would go boom, 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 your cutters went through the waves a lot better than they built for this type of service. We did an awful lot of convoy duty in World War II. We lost a lot of our men in convoy duty. I don't think the... and another thing is, I think right now, we have our own uniform. For years, we always wore a Navy uniform with a Coast Guard shield on it. We now have a uniform that's a little bit more distinctive. It still looks Navy, looks Marine-like, seaman-like, but it's still a different uniform than Navy.
Well, you were actually in the Navy.
Well, I was in the Navy too.
So you know.
I was called back in the Navy,
yeah.
And so I, but, and don't you think I got kidded too for being a hooligan? But I didn't mind it. I didn't, your expression, Coastie, I didn't get that so much as I got hooligan.
Well, that's a present day thing, that Coastie.
Oh.
You didn't hear that back during the war.
No,
this
hooligan.
Is something that somebody dreamed up, you know, fairly recently. Or lighthouse people, you know, the lighthouse guys are called Wickies.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
I was, when I was out of that pig, being with the serpent out there, we wore a surfman uniform. We didn't wear our Coast Guard uniform. We wore a surfman uniform, which was a khaki uniform with a kind of a garrison hat, a single-breasted jacket, not the double-breasted that the officers wear, was a Coast Guard emblem up in each corner. And if you were the rated man, you wore a patch in your arm. And the first time I went to New York City with a surfman uniform, I got picked up with a
and that caused a little hard feelings, you know, that we got, I wore my regular blues all the time, but, you know, if they saw a surfman or something like that, then they would get some hazing from the Navy, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, it was, I told you that I indirectly was involved with that, the German U-boats that came up the coast and landed some saboteurs out of Long Island, and we did watches, we did shore patrol, and we'd walk 4 miles, 5 miles down the beach, and walk 5 miles back, and we'd given 4 hours to watch that, to walk that. It usually was a 2.5 mile one way, 2.5 miles back. And the night that the Germans came ashore, I had come in from Hither Hills, which is all the way out in the island, back toward my station at Nampig. And as I'm coming up the along the beach there, you'd walk, because of the loose sand, you'd walk as close as you could to the ocean, even if you got your feet wet, because the sand was hard there, and it would be a lot easier walking. And we are walking up, and for the 2.5 miles that I was walking back towards my station, this U-boat was right alongside me all the way up. And German swastika on the side, and everything else, U-255 or whatever number it was. And I come back and holler up to the signal tower that we had on the beach there. I hollered up, I said, "You see that off the shore there?" And he said, "Yeah, I got to report it." I said, "Well, good, I'm going to hit the sack." And so I went up, and that was midnight then, and I went up and hit the sack. And along about an hour or so later, my roommate, who was later became a policeman out in Detroit, Michigan, he woke up, was woken up, and when he got up, he turned the lights on, and I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I'll go on back to sleep. They're calling some of the guys out there." So I went back to sleep, and they got everybody up along the whole coast. John Collins, who was at the next station up from us at Amagansett, was the one that ran into the saboteurs when they came ashore. And he took their money and went back to the station and luckily reported it to his chief, and the chief put the call in to the next station up. There was a regular telephone system all the way along the coast there. And so that they called the army out of Riverhead, and the army came down, and every Coast Guardman on the island came out, and I'm sound asleep up in... I'm sleeping through the whole excitement.
They were the only people executed by the United States for the whole war, those four saboteurs. Yeah. They caught them,
and they were executed. They were executed in Florida, too.
Yeah, I didn't know about that. I just read it in a Newsweek magazine. I was over at the Coast Guard Library.
They buried an unmarked grave.
Well, it sounds as though you felt you had good training.
Oh, yeah.
As a Coast Guard.
Oh, sure. Oh, there's no question about that. Yes.
Well, this is a very broad question, but how do you think being in the Coast Guard influenced your own sense of yourself or your identity or who you are?
Has enhanced it? Is that self-serving? Because, I mean, it's a very hard to explain, but, I mean, as I told you early on, I had a bent for this seafaring life, and then the Coast Guard gave me the opportunity to really become experienced, and then after I decided to remain in the service.
Do you know what you were making that decision based on? Why it was you'd make
it was
that
based decision? On, I'll tell you, as a matter of fact, that's a very good point. Because, to digress again from Ellis Island, I met my wife in 1953.
Why don't you say your wife's name and her birth?
My wife's name is Jean Hightone, and she met this Coast Guardsman. My wife is from Iowa, and she met this charming, handsome, dashing Coast Guardsman.
Yeah.
And, you know, she knew from nothing about the Coast Guard. She was from Des Moines, Iowa. Well, I gave her an education. I showed her some books and whatnot. But we went together for a while, and then she decided she was kind of leery about marrying a sailor. Well, I went off somewhere, I got transferred, and I met her again, and we fell in love, and we got married. Well, somehow or other, either I intimated or she assumed that I was just sort of in the service because of the war. See, again, she didn't know much about the conditions in this country during the war. She was in college at the time. Well, after things calmed down and, you know, maybe in the 50s or whatever, my enlistment was up again. See, I had to serve on enlistments. I'd be a Lieutenant JG. I'd revert back to Chief Bosun Mate, and then I would re-enlist. Well, when it came time, we had our first house, and we had one child then, and she was literally shocked to find that I was going to re-enlist. She always assumed that I would get out of the service and find a job somewhere. But I had I remember, soul-searching, and I faced the prospect of, she worked in an advertising agency in New York City, and, you know, I didn't know what to do. I spent 2 years in college learning how to be a mechanical engineer or some kind of engineering, which I know stood me in good stead in my life too, but my heart was set on the Coast Guard, and I announced that time that I'm going to stay, I'm going to remain. And she was stunned, but she very shortly got over it, and it was just based on what I really felt in my heart and soul, and that's how it was. But I had, you know, all kinds of ships. I had some really interesting jobs. Every ship I had, you know, I made some mistakes. I had a buoy tender in the Violet. I had the buoy tender in Baltimore for 3.5 years, and I didn't want to move my family around, you know, a typical military family. So for 3 years, I commuted between Yonkers and Baltimore, and that was tough on children, tough on our marriage and everything else, but we survived, and then, you know, from there on in, it sort of became easy.
Yeah. How about you?
I met my wife in 43 when I was stationed here in New York.
What's her name and maiden name?
Pauline Ferrier.
What's her last name?
Ferrier, F-E-R-R-I-E-R. She was a local girl here in New York City, worked for one of the engineering firms in the city when she got out of high school. We dated while I was stationed around this area, and then when I went overseas, we corresponded back and forth, and nothing serious. I keep kidding her because she changed me, and until I finally said, yes, I'll marry you. But that isn't the way she says it. After I came out of the service in latter part of 45, December 45, I came back to New York City and looked up some of my old flames, and she was one of them, and we start corresponding again. In the meantime, I had enrolled in a university out there in Minnesota, so I was going to school, and I had no real desire at that time to get married. I was trying to get through education and college, but I guess time went on, and their letters became more appealing. The idea of marriage became more appealing. I guess I finally said, "Well, would you take a ring?" And she said, "I'd be very happy to." So that was. In 47, we got married 2 years after I came out of the service. And we'd married here in New York City.
Do you think that being in the Coast Guard changed you in any way?
I think it gave me more maturity. I think that I had responsibilities. The funniest thing is, when I went into the university, Mr. Dr. Reif, who was head of a mission, asked me what my name was, what year did I graduate from high school, and he reached up and he grabbed a book off the shelf. It's in 1940. And he looked at it, and he went down to California Public High School. Oh, yes, there you are. And how do you think you're going to do in college? And because I see you ranked out of your graduating class, I think you're the last one in the class. And I said, well, and then you also flunked Ohio State entrance exam. And I said, well, Dr. Wright, if you can think back to 1940, what did a young kid coming from a rural high school in Minnesota have to look forward to? Either join the service, get a job, or go to college. Now, if your folks had no money to go to college, there was no GI Bill or no grants or anything. And out of our graduating class, I think there's only two people that went to college. And now, coming from a rural town, there was no jobs to have, and so you joined the military service. So when somebody came in and offered you the Ohio entrance exam, it was a big laugh. It was a big joke in class. Depends on the present price of peanuts in Peru, you know. These are the answers that we put down because we had no thought of going to school. So that when I bugged my folks to get me in the military, and they finally said, well, the United States Coast Guard is a nice, quiet organization. We'll sign you up there. I think that I had good experiences in the Coast Guard. I had good commanding officers, and I had some that was stinkos. And then the worst ones were these 90-day wonders that we got. I went to the school when I came off quartermaster school. They sent us down to Advanced Navigation School here in New York City. Now we had the same course the 90-day wonders had. The same course. We was in one classroom. The 90-day wonders were in that classroom. We had the same exam, the same test, the same instructors. They got a commission. We got a rating. And these were the guys when I went aboard the when I was shipped out to the West Coast. I went aboard this ship. This guy was a man that came out of the ranks, was given a commission and given the command of this vessel. And he didn't even know anything about navigation. So he and I finally learned navigation together on the ship. We'd argue. We'd get up on the bridge and argue about where we were in the ocean, and we would finally agree on taking a headway between the two of our morning sights and we'd say we're there. And sometimes we'd be right, sometimes wrong, but we finally learned navigation together.
Well, you said you became more mature. So did your aspirations change then as a result of being in the Coast Guard after you got out?
Well, I was on a seagoing tug most of my time out in the Pacific. And this one commanding officer that we had, I think, believed that he was paying the war debt. The year that I served aboard that ship, there was not one man made advancement and rated. And I'd go ashore, and you're talking about going ashore and you're meeting your buddies. And I'm third-class quartermaster, and I go there and I see, Joe, hey, I see your chief now, you know. And he got out of the same signal school that I did, and his commanding officer moved him along. So then 1945, when they offered me another rating to ship over, I said, no, I don't want it. I'm getting out. You can have it. I don't need it.
So you felt that you weren't really fairly ranked.
I think that I just happened to be assigned to a ship that, as the guy says.
But see, that's right. See, things like in life like that can affect your whole future, and what he's saying is so true. And that's not an isolated incident. I mean, I've been on ships where the commanding officer, I was on a great big attack transport that the commanding officer was a bona fide maniac. I mean, he was like a movie. You know, he stuck to his cabin. He never bathed. He was smelled. We loathed going down to his cabin and say, sir, the chronometers are wound. You know, we held our breath. He was a tyrant. And as a matter of fact, when I was got orders to leave a ship, I defended a guy that was unjustly court-martialed on a ship. And man, he was out to Shanghai me somewhere, and I hid down in the bowels of the ship for a couple of days until he got transferred. So, you know, this can affect your whole career. And, but by the same token, when I got to be a commanding officer of a ship, I treated my crew like family, and it made a big world of a difference. I don't want to, you know, it's not nothing to do with, you know, patting yourself on the back, but this is the way I am. See, because you wouldn't, I refused a commission the first time because of the reputation, he says, of 90-day wonders, and I poo-pooed. I says, I wouldn't serve as one an officer, you know. This is my mentality at the time. But then I kind of realized that this is a good opportunity.
Don't get me wrong. I don't say all 90-day wonders.
Right.
We needed 90-day wonders, and they was called 90-day wonders because of they were college graduates, usually put into a school where they were jammed full of naval procedures and commissioned, usually an ensign, and they needed we needed the officers to fill in billets, but. You did get some 90-day wonders that was good. I had a 90-day wonder from a shoe salesman from New Orleans that got me transferred off the ship, and I was the most happy guy in the world to get off this darn tugboat. He thought he was shafting me, and he was doing me the greatest favor because the next ship I went on, the first day I'm on that ship, the commanding officer calls me up on the bridge, and he says, I'm going through your records here, and I see you've been a quartermaster third for the last 2 years, and we're putting you in for quartermaster second right now. So it was, but you see there again, it was too late in the career,
yeah.
So that,
mm-hmm.
too late in the game, you might say. 1945 was there, and I had my points to come back home. So I never did get second class. My son right now is the chief of the Navy, and I always bugged him because I said, you should have gone in the Coast Guard. And he said, Dad, I got more opportunities in the Navy. And I guess maybe he does. It's a larger organization. He's a chief. He's stationed down in Virginia Beach. He's got 18 years in. He was one of these guys that wouldn't go to school. When he was in high school, he was in crew. You know what crew is? That's mm-hmm. these guys roll the boats. Their crew won 13 straight races. Was given a high school jacket with champs on the back of it. So in his second year, I'm finding out that he's skipping school. Mm-hmm. So I go to his council guidance counselor. And we tried to work with the guy, went to his coach. The kid was just, school turned him off. So I said, well, you got 22 choices. You're either going back to school, or you're going to join the service, or get a job. And a 17-year-old kid, you're not going to get a job. So the next day he came home with a paper and said, sign the papers for the Navy. So he went in the Navy. He's been in for 18 years now. He's made his chief. He's in charge of their computers down in Virginia Beach. He goes to Washington, D.C. about every month to work with these civilians. He's got it made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the sort of social aspect of being with, and you're both good examples of men coming from all over the country and having a job to do and working together and being sort of in that male military society, I guess you'd call it. Or is it like a fraternity, or how do you feel sort of in relation to this entity that's the military service or the Coast Guard service? Or
well, the it varied when I you know, basically during the war years it was a female less society, and then after the war, you know, I you still. There was no, you know, maybe a few of the officers on a ship or a few of the crew. We'd have ships parties on a smaller vessel. We had some terrific ships parties where everybody would come. My wife would come down, the crew members would come down, girlfriends, wives. But it varied. You know, I spent so much time in the service, and then at the academy, that was another situation. Why, the Coast Guard wives up there were great, you know what I mean? But again, I was a little different, you know, a Mustang among all the academy graduates, but we had no problem. We fitted in, and we had our part of the... And even now, see, this is another advantage. I've been out of the service for a long, long time, but my place is still like a clearing. See, I still do a lot of business with the government, Coast Guard, Navy, and people come in, you know, and they see memorabilia, my junk all around, whatnot. And they say, oh, you were in the service? Oh, yeah, I was in a while. But it's still like a kind of a little bit of a clearinghouse, but I enjoy it.
So it's a big part of your life.
It's a big part of my life. It's definitely a very big part, and still. Mm-hmm. I know now, of course, too late now, but I know I'll never lose it.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah. How about you, Bill? Do you feel like being a Coast Guard is part of your life at this point? Or?
No, I can't really say I do because... there is a space of time between when I was a Coast Guardman and when I civilian life. When I came out of the Coast Guard, I went to university. I've always been very active in Boy Scouting. So when I came out of college, I applied for a commission in the Boy Scouts and was commissioned as a executive in the Boy Scouts. So I worked for the Boy Scouts of America for 21 years. And so I've always kind of had a love for the Boy Scout movement. I still think it's one of the finest movements for youth in the country. I'm not too happy with some of the leadership that we had in the last few years. Pardon me. I think they've taken a good program and try to make it for every boy, and I don't think every boy wants to be a Boy Scout. I think that what Baden-Powell had going for him in 1910 was a good program. I think the opportunity should be given to every boy to join, but I don't think every boy is going to want to join, and other boys have baseball or sports in interest. Mm-hmm. And to my way of thinking, when I got out 21 years later, they kind of ruined the program for me, so that I was, I went into federal service at that point. I look back as a scout in my time during the Coast Guard. I look back on the good times and the bad times. I had some good commanding officers and some good duty stations, and I had some poor duty stations. But I think every GI can say the same thing. It's I have no animosity against the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm. Why were you interested in coming today here to talk about this? What is it that sort of draws you back to?
I think the main reason I wanted to, my wife and I wanted to come over to Ellis Island to see the immigration part of it, but I'm not interested in the immigration as much as I am in the other half of the island. I was on this island and off this island and on this island and off this island many times, and it was like coming back for new orders or for a new assignment or coming back for training school. And I enjoyed Ellis Island. To me, it's a historical little island in the middle of a great big metropolis. I had some good memories on Ellis Island here. And I wanted to see, basically, when Bob... I saw Bob's notice in a military magazine, I think where it was, about any Coast Guardman that received their training at signal school or quartermaster school at Ellis Island. So I wrote to Bob, and he wrote back, and we corresponded a couple times, and the idea of coming over to see my old stamping ground was intriguing. I wanted to come back and not to see the Ellis Island, the immigration part, although I think it's beautiful and what you've done here is great, but I wanted to see the other part of the island, which was my home for off and on for many, many years and many, many months, many, many days. That I wanted to see, and I wanted to renew old memories, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about you? Do you know what drew you to want to come today?
Of course. I'm a Coast Guardsman, and this is where it started. Yeah, I have lots of memories about those early days, and I've met through the years a lot of people that have been to Ellis Island, and I got all excited when I heard about this trip today. I was really enjoyed it because I've been so busy. That's been my problem, and I never take the time, as they say, to smell the roses. But I thought this was a perfect opportunity. I wouldn't have to fight the crowds to get to South Ferry, where do you park and whatever. And when Bob Isles contacted me through another fellow who was well acquainted with my deeply embedded Coast Guard feelings, why, that's how we got together. And when he told me about this, I started to make plans immediately.
Well, now, is there anything else that either of you would like to say in closing?
I'm looking forward to seeing this old part of the island that I'm looking forward to seeing.
I read about, I've got, I kind of clip articles, everything I see on Ellis Island, and I'm not too enthused about the future plans for the rest of the island. It's too bad, but by the same token, I realize we can't make this a mecca for Coast Guardsmen only. I mean, it's in the entire thing, it's really probably a small segment of the history of Ellis Island, but I just don't go along with this. I unless I'm wrong, I understand they're going to make condominiums and a big meeting buildings and hotels and things like that.
I think there was some talk about ripping down your old hospital buildings and coming up with conference centers and stuff like that.
Yep.
Which I'm again. I realize there's you can't preserve everything historical. You can't keep everything that's old. Newness must come in the picture someplace. But I hope that we can still keep Ellis Island as, and I think you've done a beautiful job here on the immigration, what I've seen at the immigration building. It's been a big change since what I saw it in 1941, dirty papers, papers laid all over, chairs upturned, dirty floor, dirty windows, broken windows, pigeons all over the place. It's quite a change, and it's changed for the better. What you're going to do with the rest of the island, I don't know, but I hope it's going to kind of keep
the flavor of what it was.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what you can do with those the hospital buildings over there, but I hope somehow it can be preserved, and I think this is pretty much what you feel. It's we read these articles about what's going to happen in Ellis Island, and I know that for years was originally, I think Ellis Island was offered to New York City, and New York City didn't want it, and then finally somehow the Park Commission took it over. But I hope the Park Commission, and I realize the Park Commission's got a lot of problems, and. Because I'm a Civil War buff, and I hate to see what's happening in some of our national parks with the Civil War part of it. The land is not being, I realize land today is expensive, and you can't buy up whole counties because there was a soldier that fought there. But
one of the most disappointing things that have happened here is that poor old ferry boat. That was such a fantastic old ferry boat. And for years that thing laid in that slip, and I tried to make waves, pardon the pun again, lots of times. I belong to this Steamship Historical Society of America, and we talked about it and all that. But to galvanize people into something to try to save that thing, and they just watched it rot, and she sunk right in the slip, and that was a crime. Yeah. Mm. It's really too bad. Because that
it's
ferry.
There now.
Pardon me?
Well, they tried.
There.
Well, it's on the bottom, yeah.
Well, they tried their best, I guess, to raise it.
But it was too late. She's all.
It was too late then,
apart.
Yeah.
But ironically, in 1976, I think, we have a magazine called Soundings, you know, it has articles and advertising. And I have a advertisement for my business on the bottom of a page. And right over the advertisement is a nice picture of the old tug right in the slip at Ellis Island. Isn't that coincidence?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it when I was rifling through my old papers, because, you know, I save everything. Uh-huh. And there was this picture. But that's too bad, because that played a pretty important part of the lives of a lot of Coast Guardsmen.
Yeah, your liberty, that was
it.
Your, the gang
came over in that tug or else.
Right. Manhattan.
It
was,
so it probably meant more to you as the Coast Guards rather than it did to anybody.
Oh, I think so. Definitely, yes. Yes, yes.
Well, I want to thank you both very, very much. This has been
my pleasure.
Most enjoyable, and you really had such interesting.
Well, thank you.
And
I got off to a rocky start, but I think things sort of came back to me again.
Yeah, certainly did. Okay, this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I've been speaking with William Dorival.
Yes.
And Ludwig Rubinsky, and we're here in the studio at Ellis Island. It's May 18th, 1994, and I'm signing off. Thank you.